Hello, Explorer. Welcome along to the club. We're going on an adventure to try and search out the secrets laying around the solar system. It's a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thank you so much for being there. This is the only place where we discover all the science that no one else bothers about. We learn what's really out there. This week, you can hear all about a brand new gallery that's at a museum. It's filled with loads of hands-on stuff to explain energy and how it's changing in the future.
We're showing some of these technologies from solar panels to big wind farm generators. And the exciting thing for me, I think, is to get up close and personal to some of these technologies and see them for yourself and appreciate that those can help us in our future to be more responsible on this planet.
Also, I've got some of your questions to answer. And this week, one will take us into space to take a look at baby stars.
Fusion of hydrogen into helium, and that's the point that it becomes a star. So essentially, a protostar becomes a star when it's gathered enough mass and when that core gets to 10 million degrees.
And we will hear about one of the rarest animals on the planet. It's a creature that's not really been spotted for 10 years. It's all coming up in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's kick things off with your science in the news. And we start with some sad news. Sewage spills into England's rivers and seas by water companies more than doubled last year. According to the Environment Agency, there were 3.6 million hours of spills compared to 1.75 million hours the year before. So all those millions of hours, think of how much water, how much sewage is being pumped into our rivers, our seas. Water UK, the industry body for sewerage companies, said it was unacceptable, but record levels were down to heavy rain. So we've had a lot of rain and that's flooding places where sewage is kept and it can't help but overflow. But you can understand why some people are frustrated with the water companies, because all of this muck is being pumped into rivers, seas and other places that we can swim. Also this week, SpaceX's Starship rocket made big progress in its third test flight. The two-stage vehicle had a clean getaway from its launch site over in Texas. It set its up a bit around the globe, which re-entered over the Indian Ocean. Now, radio contact was lost towards the end, but SpaceX say it was incredible to see how far it got this time around. It's weird and amazing, isn't it? We've been following SpaceX, that's Elon Musk's space company. We've been following their attempts to blast rockets into the atmosphere, and they do get better and better each time. I wonder where they might be in a year from now. And our final story this week, a brand new gallery that explores the past, the present and the future of energy has opened at the Science Museum. It's called Energy Revolution, the Adani Green Energy Gallery, and it examines how the world can limit climate change. This is something we are very keen to talk about. So let's find out more with a gallery curator at the Science Museum, Oliver Carpenter. There are so many different ideas that we can have about climate change, ways to save the world, and ways to present climate change. When you were coming up with a new gallery, how did you start?
I guess it starts from, we all know that burning things such as coal, oil, gas is actually really useful for generating electricity to power the things that we need, such as our lights, our TVs, our toasters, but also things such as petrol and diesel can be burnt to power our cars, buses, big ships across the oceans. But unfortunately, when you burn things, this releases things called greenhouse gases into the air, which can warm the planet and can cause more kind of extreme weather, such as heavy rains or floods, or in some places, less rain or fires. So if we kind of wanted to avoid the worst, effects of climate change, we really need to change the way we do energy, our energy sources, to ones that don't release these greenhouse gases. And that's what's called the low carbon energy transition. And this is what the gallery at the Science Museum is all about.
That's what's it about. So what's in it then? What can we find if we wander around?
Yeah, well, we've got a whole range of potential options for the future of energy. And we are displaying many of these inventions or technologies together in our gallery for our visitors to come and experience for themselves. So, for example, we've got probably the oldest electric car, certainly in the country. Your listeners might, families might own an electric car, and they're quite modern technologies. But this one's from the 1890s. It's over 120 years old. So it's to kind of say that some of the technology for the, you know, for this energy transition, we've had for a long time, and it's just about how we use them more effectively in the future. So that's one really cool thing. It's a bright yellow and black electric taxi. It was nicknamed the Bumblebee, and it drove around the streets of London in the 1890s. So I'm really looking forward to people to come and have a close look at this electric taxi.
Do we know anything about why it was made and then why we didn't make more?
Yeah, so it was invented by a man called Walter Bursey. It's called the Bursey Electric Taxi Cab. And he was really competing with the horse. It was a company called the Great Horseless Carriage Company. And it really does look like a carriage that's not without a horse. And so he was trying to kind of clean up the streets of London in a way, because there wouldn't be any horse manure or horses wouldn't get tired. And the batteries on this electric taxi cab, you could just take out and replace with charged batteries. And then it would go off and take passengers around the city, you know, for as long as the batteries lasted.
And this gallery looks at the past, the present, and the future of energy. In your time, what have you learned about how our knowledge of energy, how it's changed through the years?
Well, really, I suppose how our knowledge has changed is that getting a better appreciation of the effects of our energy choices. And so, you know, now we know that burning a lot of fossil fuels can be damaging to the planet. And we've got so many exciting technologies to use to help us move away from burning. And we're showing some of these technologies, from solar panels to big wind farm generators. And the exciting thing for me, I think, is to get up close and personal to some of these technologies and see them for yourself and appreciate that those can help us in our future to be more, you know, responsible on this planet.
You say get up close. One of the things the Science Museum always does really well, we get hands-on in a way that we aren't able to do at other museums and other galleries. What can we do? What can we touch? What can we play with at the Adani Green Energy Gallery?
One thing that I think's quite cool is that we all know about batteries, and you know, if there's a battery on your game or your electronic device, and it can run out and you can need to recharge it. But we've got a hands-on experience of a gravity battery. So not all batteries use chemicals to store energy. So if you've got an excess in energy, say on a really windy day when there's so much wind and that generates electricity from wind farms, you could store that electricity by winching up a weight inside a very deep hole, such as an old mine shaft. And then you can use that energy later on when you need it by releasing the weight. Gravity takes the weight down, and then electricity is generated from a turbine motor there. So we've got a hands-on exhibit where you can winch up your gravity battery, press a button, and then that releases the weight, slowly drops to the ground and generates electricity. And so that's a kind of a hands-on one. We've also got a couple of games where you can step inside the shoes of an engineer working on different problems, such as balancing a national grid to help keep it running with all these renewable and sometimes variable energy sources, or placing solar energy in different parts of the world where it's needed the most. So there's plenty on offer to get hands-on, as well as up close to the historic or new objects in the gallery.
So Energy Revolution, the Adani Green Energy Gallery, is looking at the past, the present, and the future. And because you've been looking and researching that, if you were to make this gallery again in like 50 years, what might you put in it? What are we doing now that might become incredible and world-saving in a few years' time?
One of the kind of technologies that really excited me, and, you know, if achieved, could be a real, you know, exciting prospect for the future, is fusion power. And this is the reaction that powers the sun and all the stars in the universe. And if we could, you know, recreate those reactions down on Earth, then we might have potential unlimited energy to power all our needs.
And if it's good enough for the sun, surely it's good enough for us. Well, listen, the new exhibition is Energy Revolution, the Adani Green Energy Gallery. It's on at the Science Museum. Oliver Carpenter has been involved in putting it together. Thank you so much for joining us, Oliver.
No problem. Thanks very much for having me.
Let's get to your questions then. We have one which will take us across the universe in just a second to look at Iddle Biddle Baby Stars. Now, if you have a question that you really want answered, make sure you send it to us. Best way is by leaving it as a voice, though, on the free Fun Kids app, or you can do it to funkidslive.com too. This one has been sent in as a message to me from Raffy. Thank you, Raff. Raffy asks, why, when you see someone yawn, do you want to yawn? Do you know what's amazing about this? It's something that we do all the time, that everyone knows what happens. You don't have to be Albert Einstein to know if you see someone yawn, it's quite contagious. You'll likely yawn yourself. Even with all that, experts don't exactly know. They think it might have evolved. So over hundreds and thousands of years, we've evolved that ability that we yawn when other people do, maybe to keep us on our toes or unaware. If you need to be on guard and you see someone yawning, it might make you yawn and help you realise that, hang on, you maybe are a bit tired. You should be extra vigilant and aware because other people feel tired. Maybe it snaps you into action. That would have been really helpful in times when we were cavemen, right? If you saw someone, probably hairy, with a huge club in his hand, if you saw them yawning, you'd think, oh, hang on, they're a bit tired. Maybe I need to snap to attention. Maybe I need to get to it. And the reason that we yawn really isn't to do with us being tired. It's because we've not taken in enough oxygen when we're breathing. So you have one massive breath, and that's what a yawn is. Experts also think it might be to do with social mirroring. When you see someone do something, your brain thinks it might be a good thing to do. Have you ever had that when you see someone scratch their face and suddenly yours gets a bit itchy? It's your brain that constantly almost makes you want to fit in. It's always looking for different cues and ways that you can improve and figure out what to do. So, Raffy, that's why we think that we yawn and why we think that we yawn when we see other people yawn, but we don't exactly know. Thank you so much for that question. Let's get on another one. This is a voice note sent into the Free Fun Kids app by Danny.
I would like to know, how does a protostar change into a star?
Danny, thank you for your question. All about a protostar turning into a proper star, I guess. And I've got some help. And whenever we travel across the galaxy, there's one person I turn to first because they know everything. Dara Patel from the National Space Centre joins us. Dara, thank you for being there. So let's start off. What is a protostar?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So a protostar is basically just a very, very young star, which hasn't yet started what we call nuclear fusion. So this process whereby stars give out their own light in heat. So it's just really young and it's still growing and collecting material or mass.
Now, really young in star terms, you know, it's not a week old, is it? How old are these really young stars?
Yeah, astronomically speaking, when we talk about time, it's never kind of the time we're used to. So when we're talking about a relatively young star, we're probably talking, you know, a few 100,000 years at the bare minimum where these stars start to grow. And it may take, you know, a few million years for them to become a fully fledged star.
So with humans, we have very clear boundaries on ages, right? When you're up to about a year old, then you're a baby, then you become a toddler, then you become a kid, then you become a teenager, then you're an adult, right? Is it similar with stars? Do we have defined names for ages?
Yeah, in a sense we do, but they're not necessarily a particular and defined age. So it's more a broad range of sort of ages. So a protostar is anywhere from, I guess, a few, like we said, hundreds of thousands of years when they're collecting material, up to a few tens of millions of years, perhaps when they become a nuclear fusing star, or what we call a proper star. But then stars can live for many more millions of years. Stars like our sun will live for billions of years. And there are even very small stars, which actually use their fuel very slowly, that can live for trillions of years. So when we think about stars and their ages, it doesn't really give us an idea of their true age. But thinking about our sun, it's about 4.5 billion years old. And we consider it to be like a middle-aged adult. It's about halfway through its life.
So we know what a protostar is. The question, how does it turn into a star? So what has to happen for it to decide to make nuclear fusion?
Yeah, so stars are basically born from what we call molecular clouds, or a prettier word, a nebula. So these big clouds of gas and dust in space. And essentially something happens that causes this material to be pulled together by gravity. So that might be a shockwave from a relatively nearby star that's exploded, or it might be from something like two galaxies that are colliding, and then therefore the clouds within them start to get closer together and knock into each other. So when this material comes together, gravity pulls it together to form what we call a dense core. And then eventually it's kind of a balancing act between gravity pulling this material in, and then a bit like when you've got a balloon and you fill it with air, you get pressure from the gas inside the balloon pushing back outwards and expanding the balloon. So it's like this balancing act between the star, lots of material being pulled in and that star trying to hold itself up. But eventually gravity wins and it pulls enough material together to the point where that core gets to 10 million degrees Kelvin, which is roughly 10 million degrees Celsius. And that's the point where it can undergo fusion of hydrogen into helium. And that's the point that it becomes a star. So essentially, a protostar becomes a star when it's gathered enough mass and when that core gets to 10 million degrees.
We know what stars look like. These brilliant, bright balls of energy fusion happening all the time. What do we know about how protostars look?
Yeah, so protostars, when they're very small and they're just starting to pull that material together, they're not going to be very well visible. So we're not going to be able to see them very easily. And in fact, they're hiding within these huge clouds of gas and dust, which makes them tricky to spot anyway. But as they gather more material, although they're not giving out light by nuclear fusion, they are getting warmer. So just like when you pump air into a bike tire, we know that the tire gets hot, right? The air in there is being squashed together and therefore it gets a bit hotter. Similarly, these protostars, once they start to gather enough material, they will get hotter and they will emit light in the form of infrared. So some of you might have heard of infrared light. We have infrared cameras to see hot bodies in the dark. And similarly, we can use infrared telescopes to spot these protostars in this huge cloudy regions in space where they're starting to form.
How well have we done with spotting them? We are quite close to a star with our sun. We know where other ones are around us. What about protostars? Do we have any idea of where they are in the universe and how many we might have?
Yeah, so there are telescopes all over the world that are actually looking for protostars. And we're starting to find more and more evidence of protostars in the earlier stages of their lives. So with things like the James Webb Space Telescope that works with infrared light, we're able to see these protostars forming earlier than we'd been able to see them before. But of course, we're still not yet at the stage where we completely understand perhaps exactly how protostars come to be and exactly what they're like at the beginning of their lives. But we're starting to put together a much better picture. And in fact, lots of stars are actually born together from the same cloud of gas and dust. And so one of the big questions is, well, if our sun was born in a similar way, where are all the other stars that our sun would have been born with?
Like star twins, star triplets, star quadruplets. Do we know very quickly if they have any connection? If the sun does have a twin that's been born from the same kind of nebula, is there any link? Do we know?
Yeah, so this is one of the, I guess, one of the bigger questions. We've not yet understood whether our sun is a little bit of a deviant or a little bit of an oddity, that it didn't quite form like we see many of these other protostars forming. But if it did form in a group, one of the big questions is, okay, so what happened to those stars? So it's still a bit of a mystery. It's still a bit of an unknown.
And that is why when we got any question across the galaxy, we head straight to the National Space Centre. Dara Patel, thank you so much for helping us with Danny's question.
No worries.
Let's get to this week's Dangerous Dan. We're going into the mountains around Vietnam to try and find the Saola. And I really mean try and find it. It's one of the rarest animals on the planet. It was first discovered back in 1992, so 30 years ago, when forest scientists were searching mountains for anything unusual. That was 92. The last time one was photographed was in 2013. It's in the bovine family, the Saola, so it's closely related to cattle and goats and antelopes. Here's the thing, it's known as the Asian unicorn. because it's from Asia and a few other reasons. It's rare, just like a unicorn. Perhaps people think it's mystical. But also, it's got two huge horns, just like a unicorn. This creature has two long, slender horns that can stretch back. They arch from the top of its head to over a metre tall. It's got a dark brown coat with white markings on its face and legs, which make it incredibly tough to spot in the wild. It blends in with the snow or with the rocks around the mountains where it lives. And because of this, we don't know how many there are, really. It's a pretty endangered species, but there could be loads. I don't know. Probably isn't, as experts from Vietnam would see it more and more and would know more about it, you might think. But who knows? Maybe they're there and just really good at hiding. It's got hooves and thick teeth. And here's something strange. In the past, when people have found them, they have captured them, taken them to try and study them. But sadly, the animals don't last very long in captivity. They die quite quickly. It's sad, it's strange, no one really knows why. And it's one of the rarest animals on the planet, which is why the Saola goes onto our dangerous Dan list. Let's head back into space then, shall we? And catch up with one of our favourite geniuses, Professor Pulsar. With Dara Patel earlier on, we heard all about protostars. What about other types of stars? Well, Professor Pulsar is an expert on space, and he joins us to tell us some of the other things that move through the universe, like shooting stars, and why some of them twinkle.
Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service, with support from the UK Space Agency. Somewhere between Polaris and Ursa Minor, just a glint in the night sky to the naked eye. But look a little closer, and you will see it is Professor Pulsar's exploration craft, the Intrepid 5, piloted by trusted Captain T. Torrey. While the pupils of Deep Space High take their school holidays, Pulsar is roaming the universe to explore the most dastardly difficult mysteries of space and broadcasting his findings back to the planets. It can only be another episode of Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service.
Professor, I'm picking up some incoming data on the mid-range scanners.
Stand by. It sounds like another question.
Star shooting cause what the...
Goodness me, I'm used to tricky questions, but I can't understand what that even means. Computer, replay that question.
Accessing database, replay last question.
Star shooting cause what the...
Professor, I think that question may have got scrambled up on its way from Earth. Computer, run the de-scrambling program on it.
What caused the shooting star?
Great work, Captain T. Torrey. Right, let's get on the case of solving this little mystery. Computer, can you find me an expert, please?
Searching. This looks promising. Stevenage, England on planet Earth, patching through to flight deck.
This is Captain T. Torrey of the Intrepid 5. Please identify yourself.
My name's Sean, and I'm an engineer at Airbus Defence and Space.
Loading file. As the world's second largest aerospace company, Airbus Defence and Space has expertise in a range of disciplines, from aircraft to defence to space. One of the projects it is working on at the moment is the Solar Orbiter, a satellite mission launching in 2017, which will travel to the Sun to closely study areas which are difficult to view from Earth. It is hoped it will help us learn more about the complex workings of the Sun.
Thanks, computer. So, Sean, we have a bit of a cosmic conundrum that you might be able to help with. Can you explain what causes shooting stars?
Well, in space, there's lots of particles and bits of rock floating around. And every now and then, one of these usually quite tiny pieces of rock enters the top of the Earth's atmosphere. And because it's travelling so quickly, it appears to burn up in the upper atmosphere. And that's what we see as a shooting star. So it's not actually a star, it's just a piece of debris or rock that's coming into our atmosphere. Most shooting stars come from pieces of rock that are from the size of a grain of sand, so really, really tiny, up to probably about a metre in diameter. So they're not actually that big, so it's quite impressive that we can see them all the way from the ground and they can streak right across the sky.
Thanks, Sean. You're a star.
Professor, I have another star-related question flagged on the database. Perhaps there's another expert at Airbus who can help.
Expert identified. Connecting.
Well done, T. Torrey. Who are we speaking to?
Hi, I'm Kyle Palmer. I've just finished university and I'm now working at Airbus Defence and Space in future missions, which means I design all the future missions that won't be launching till after 2020.
Good, good. Computer, please load up our question for Kyle.
Why do some stars twinkle and others don't?
So stars themselves are basically suns like our own and are just as bright, if not a lot brighter. But they're very, very far away, which means that it takes a while for the starlight to reach us. And when it does, it then has to pass through our very thick atmosphere so that we can actually see them. And when we see them, they appear to twinkle because of all the light rays are hitting off all the stuff in the atmosphere, and they look really faint and they twinkle. The stars which appear to not twinkle are actually satellites and the International Space Station and planets in our own solar system, which are a lot closer to us, and therefore they're a lot brighter in the sky, and that means that we don't quite see the twinkling quite as much.
Well, a shining example of a space mystery solved.
Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service, with support from the UK Space Agency. Continue your space exploration at funkidslive.com/deepspacehigh.
And that's it for this week's episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for catching up with us. If you have anything sciencey that you want answered next week on the podcast, make sure you leave it as a voice note for me on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. You heard Professor Pulsar a second ago. We've got loads more brilliant podcasts and episodes for you to listen to on Google, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your shows, and they're at funkidslive.com too. And Fun Kids are our children's radio station from the UK. Listen all over the country, on the app, on our website, and if you've got a smart speaker, wake it up and ask it to play Fun Kids.